listening to The Realist Report. And now your host, John Friend.
All right, folks, welcome back to another edition of The Realist Report. This is your host, John Friend. The website is therealistreport.com, where you can find an extensive archive of these podcasts, as well as other radio programs I've participated in. You will also find all of my articles and blog posts, a contact page, my Twitter feed, which is embedded in the right-hand sidebar of the website, and many other useful and important links. I am a regular reporter for American Free Press, America's last real newspaper, and I also contribute to the Barnes Review, the bi-monthly history magazine affiliated with American Free Press. Please do subscribe to these fine print publications. Check out AmericanFreePress.net and BarnesReview.org for more details. All right, with that said, let me introduce my special guest today. Dr. Alan Sobroski is a former U.S. Marine who served two tours in Vietnam with the 1st Marine Division and went on to receive his Ph.D. from the University of Michigan. Dr. Sobroski previously served as the Director of Studies, Strategic Studies Institute at the U.S. Army War College and has written and spoken extensively about 9/11, U.S. foreign policy, and related matters over the years. He has had a tremendous influence on my thinking and overall perspective of 9/11, and I am absolutely thrilled and honored to have him here with me today. Dr. Sobroski, welcome to the program, sir. How are you?
Excellent. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Yes, thank you so much. I'm so glad that we connected. You are somebody that, as I mentioned in the intro, had a tremendous influence on my thinking. When I was first researching 9/11, I came across your work relatively quickly. I discovered it through Daryl Bradford Smith's website, IamTheWitness.com. And I know you have been interviewed by him, I believe at least once, probably more than that. And I heard you on Mark Glenn's radio program, and you were talking about 9/11. You were this very reputable and, you know, intelligent man, obviously. You know, you have a lot of experience in these matters, U.S. foreign policy and in analyzing events. So, and you just explained everything so clearly and articulately, you know, it was very, very powerful and had a huge influence on my thinking. So, to kind of get started, can you just give a brief background, maybe your experience in the military and your educational experience?
Sure. I enlisted in the Marines in 1959, 10 years enlisted service with those two tours in Vietnam, got my bachelor's degree during those 10 years, even with those two tours aside, got my discharge in 1969 when I completed my undergraduate degree in North Carolina, went to the University of Michigan for master's in history, master's in political science, PhD in political science, taught at a variety of places, Middlebury College, the Military Academy at West Point, Catholic University, University of Pennsylvania, Army War College, Georgetown University, Johns Hopkins School for Advanced International Studies. As a civilian, I also attended and am a graduate of the U.S. Army War College. In fact, I think I was the first civilian faculty member up there to do that. Others did it afterwards, but it was rather interesting. Did a lot of traveling, including some, how should I put this, interesting vacations in Northern Ireland with the British Army, in South Africa with the South African Defense Force during apartheid. Had some very intriguing background. I think the thing that has struck me most, and it has nothing really to do with 9/11, but it's a sense of a cultural shift, is that I just recently saw some real-time videos of Lauren Southern, a Canadian journalist in Britain, and the contrast between London now and the London I remembered from the late 80s and early 90s was dramatic and appalling. You know, there may not longer be an England. but my exposure to 9/11, and I remember when it happened, I think almost all of us remember where we were when it happened. I was watching a television in a supermarket when the second plane hit. I had no particular connections into the Washington community at that time. About 2 weeks after 9/11, I got a call from a local journalist in Jackson, Mississippi, asking me if I had any questions about it. And that got me to thinking about it. And I actually had several questions, things that made no sense. For example, the supposed hijackers running around flight schools making spectacles of themselves, when they could have gotten flight training in any one of dozens of Muslim countries with the support and assistance of the governments and the armed forces, and not made themselves so visible that it was almost as if they wanted to be seen, remembered, and identified. Doing a drunken revel at a bar in Boston the night before the hijackings. And I said, you know, you can be devout or you can be drunk, but a Muslim can't be both. And, it, you know, things of this nature that just made no sense whatsoever. And then about 2 months later, I revised that slightly, and it's out there available as Early Reflections on 9/11. And I forgot about it. I completely forgot about 9/11 from November of 2001 until basically early 2009. I paid no attention to it. I did pay attention to our wars. I didn't see any justification for the war in Afghanistan. I thought, you know, the Afghan leadership was not my cup of tea, to put it mildly. But I didn't see anything wrong with their basic position, which was show us the evidence and we'll give them to you. And the U.S., of course, had no evidence of bin Laden or his attacks. In fact, he denied having made the attacks on a report aired by BBC a few weeks after 9/11. We planned on a number of wars within 3 weeks of 9/11, including, I think it was the overthrow of 7 countries in 5 years, according to General Wesley Clark. I completely opposed the war in Iraq because I knew most of the people around the Pentagon who were planning this. But I didn't think anything more of 9/11. I basically accepted the U.S. government's overt explanation of it. My questions and reservations in those 2 weeks after 9/11 notwithstanding, you know, had no reason to question it, had no reason to go back onto it and review it, because it was almost as if to think anything else would be so monstrous that I couldn't even believe that people like Paul Wolfowitz and Douglas Feith, whom I knew fairly well, and Richard Pearl, whom I knew well, would have done such a thing. I was obviously wrong. But what brought me back into 9/11 was almost a back door. It was Operation Cast Lead, which is the Israeli attack on Gaza City in late 2008-2009. And that truly appalled me, and that got me back into looking at the whole range of issues encompassing both Israel and its principal lobbies in the U.S., AIPAC in particular, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, and just how much influence they had on the U.S. government. I had been generally aware of it beforehand, but starting in December 2008, January 2009, I guess I became what you could call an activist. Then I started looking at it very hard, in very great detail, at many of the ramifications of Israeli control of the U.S. government, of Israeli domination of the American mainstream media, of its influence on the academic community, of its control of so much of the ebb and flow of elections and electoral politics, and of the extent to which its money, and particularly of a handful of Jewish billionaires, largely dictating the nomination process of both major parties. And when all of this came together, I began doing some writing on it, and then began invited by a number of people to do interviews on it. And I found out how it feels to get into the gun sights of people like AIPAC, it's Hasbro, it's Public Diplomacy Group, basically it's disinfo people of the SPLC and a number of others.
Yes.
And it's really an impressive feeling to be in that gun sight.
Yes. I know the feeling. you know, and that's fascinating, because it had to have been late 2009, early 2010, I believe, is that would have been when you were appearing on like Daryl Bradford Smith and Mark Glenn. It was right around that time. Yeah. And then I remember hearing about it. Yeah. It had been 2010, because I'm looking at my old blog, and I have a couple articles that I wrote about. You wrote about some of your writings and some of these interviews, and a lot of the documents that like the Project for a New American Century put out, and mm-hmm. other, you know, sort of neocon thinkers and writers, where they were basically openly advocating for a global war on terrorism. They were just looking for some sort of excuse, some sort of game-changing event, which I think is literally in the document.
The phrase they use is catalytic event.
Catalytic event. There you go. Yeah, they needed a catalytic event to justify and kickstart and really institutionalize this idea of a global war on terrorism. And of course, that's exactly what 9/11 was. So yeah, I mean, again, your research, you know, is very, very sound. It made perfect sense to me. It explained everything. In fact, I, in an article that I wrote on March 15th of 2011, which I'll have linked in this blog post, it's titled Dr. Alan Sobrosky, Israel Behind 9/11. I have a little excerpt of an article you wrote. Let me just read this really quick, because I think it summarizes it all perfectly. You argue here only two intelligence agencies had the expertise, assets, access, and political protection to execute 9/11 in the air and on the ground: our CIA and Israel's Mossad. Only one had the incentive, using the who benefits principle, Mossad. And that incentive dovetailed perfectly with the neocons' agenda and explicitly expressed need for a catalytic event to mobilize the American public for the wars, using American military power to destroy Israel's enemies. Only the unexpected strength of the Iraqi resistance kept Syria and Iran from being attacked in the second Bush administration. Thus, the evidential trail for 9/11 and the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq run from PNAC, the Project for a New American Century, AIPAC, and their cohorts, through the mostly Jewish neocons in the Bush administration, and back to the Israeli government itself. And that is a perfect summation of what 9/11 was all about. And we can, you know, elaborate on this a little bit, but when I remember reading that and just being like, wow, this all makes sense now.
Mm-hmm. It does, and what's interesting, and if you don't have the video, I'll send you a link to it. The former Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, General Wesley Clark, did an interview in 2007. And there's about a 7-8 minute excerpt, which is worth seeing. And I'm going to summarize it for your listeners, because if they, I will send it to you. And
yeah, please do. I can post it when I post this blog post, so everyone else can see it as well.
I will send it to you within 10 minutes of us finishing the interview. But what Wes did, he was retired. And I'd known him back when he was a colonel, and we'd both taught at West Point, social sciences department. But Wes is looking at the woman who's interviewing him. He's saying, you know, that he was in the Pentagon, still on active duty, a four-star general, a couple of weeks. And I'm paraphrasing what he said to her in the interview. A couple of weeks after 9/11, And you said this army general, and didn't say who he was or what rank he was, but an army general officer who had worked with him in Europe said, "General, come on in here. You've got to see this." And he said to him, "What is it?" He said, "We're going to war with Iraq." With Iraq. And this was 2 weeks after 9/11 with the troops just in the process of attacking Afghanistan. And Clark says, "Why, have they linked Iraq to 9/11? And this other general says, "No." And Clark asks him, he said, "Well, why are we going to war with Iraq?" And the general in the Pentagon says, "I don't know." He said, but the decision has been made upstairs. Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, and Feith, you know, Secretary of Defense, Deputy Secretary of Defense, Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, to do this. And Clark said he sort of leaned back. And a few weeks later, he was back in the Pentagon. And the same general officer said to him, "General, you got to come in and look at this." And Clark comes in and, you know, and Clark on this interview, this video interview, you know, demonstrates what happens. He picks up a piece of paper and hands it like he's handing it to the woman who's interviewing him. And he said, you know, this general handed you the paper and he said, we're going to war with 7 countries in 5 years. It's going to be regime change in 7 countries in 5 years. This was probably October, I'm guessing October plus or minus a week or two of 2001, that the decision had been made to take out 7 countries in 5 years. Afghanistan, Iraq, Somalia, Libya, Syria, Yemen, Iran. And when Clark said, when he was back in the Pentagon several weeks later, he had a brief conversation with Frank, said, "I never showed you anything. I never gave you anything," you know, sort of like that. It's a really fascinating video.
Yes, I know the interview you're referring to. I've seen it as well. And it's incredible how that's exactly what happened in the aftermath of 9/11, basically, anyways.
It is. And, you know, what's really intriguing right now, and I should say interesting in the sense of the ancient Chinese curse, is that while the Iraqi resistance, which was so much stronger than anyone expected, you know, certainly the mostly Jewish neocons, they were contemptuous of Arabs, you know, the collapse of the Iraqi army under assault simply confirmed their contempt. I mean, the fact that it didn't have a chance, it was like somebody with a pistol fighting somebody with machine guns. Of those, it delayed the neocons' agenda, but the neocons persisted, just a different set of names, in the Obama administration, and they're back in the Trump administration. And of those 7 countries, although the timetable was thrown off by the Iraqi resistance, the only one not yet crushed is Iran. Libya has been trashed. Syria will be generations recovering. Iraq has been ripped apart. Somalia has been ripped apart. Yemen is ripped apart. Afghanistan is still churning inside, and the Afghans are showing us what they showed the British before us and the Russians and even Alexander the Great. You know, you can take Afghanistan, but holding it is something else. But Iran is the last one standing. And this is where you see now the lines are forming to take out Iran.
Exactly. Yeah. And they've been after Iran for decades now, it seems like. You know, it's so incredible how just crystal clear this all is. I mean, they're openly saying these things. They've been advocating this sort of stuff for decades. In fact, the whole idea of a global war on terrorism, it goes back to like the 70s, if I'm not mistaken. I know I've heard Dr. Kevin Barrett talk about this pretty extensively. I've written about it over the years as well. But basically, the idea was concocted by Netanyahu and other sort of like hawkish Zionist Israelis over in Israel. And of course, you know, the Jewish neocons in America and in the West were advocates of this as well. But again, they needed some sort of justification for it, some sort of event to kickstart it all and kind of get it going. And of course, that's what 9/11 was. So, I mean, again, if you just do like the basic research into all this, it's pretty obvious. It's like not a secret. They're openly saying these things, and we can point to their own words and their own documents to prove it all.
Yeah, you know, but and it's not only the catalytic event. There were traces of what could have been a war on terror in the 1970s and 1980s, but it was only theoretical. And the reason it was only theoretical was because as long as the Soviet Union was in existence, most American military power was tied down in Europe and Northeast Asia. Most American military power was tied down there. It would not have been possible to have waged the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq with the Soviet Union in place. It would not have been possible. The troops were not there. The divisions were not there. The aircraft were not there. They could not have been pulled out of NATO Europe and out of Northeast Asia. The end of the Soviet Union was a prerequisite to the war on terror.
Yes.
And the resurgence of Russia, I mean, it helped to have a drunken lout like Boris Yeltsin, who was our favorite Russian leader. You know, we could plunder Russia and it was sitting off there on the side. And on those rare moments when he was sober, he may have had some reservations, but he didn't stay sober long enough to do anything about it. But Putin is a different can of worms. Or he's a different bear. He's a real different bear. As far as the neocons are concerned, and he is a can of worms for the neocon because he's been rebuilding Russian military power really fast. And, yeah. And that's the sort of thing that, I find this very strange. You know, I spent almost all of my adult life in opposition to the Soviet Union as a greater Russian empire, you know, which is basically what it was. They called it the Soviet Union, but it was a Russian empire. And I find it very strange to think now that, you know, the last best hope of averting global catastrophe is a strong Russia under a strong president.
I know. I totally understand. Well, getting back to 9/11, I think it's pretty clear to me that 9/11 is really kind of the focal point of U.S. foreign policy. U.S. foreign policy revolves around 9/11. So in that sense, it really was a game-changing event, a paradigm-shifting event. And you make this argument as well. You've called it like the Schwerpunkt, I think is the German word. Mm-hmm. It's the strategic center of gravity around which our foreign policy, our security policy, this whole idea of, you know, like homeland security now, it all revolves around 9/11, the official 9/11 narrative of radical Islamic terrorists connected to Osama bin Laden in this international network of, you know, mysterious Muslim extremists, which is largely a fiction. You know what I mean? I mean, I think a lot of this stuff is kind of just concocted by the media. And where it does exist, a lot of these people are tied into Western and Israeli intelligence. So they're being manipulated and played by intelligence agencies to do these things. And you know, they just present this Muslim boogeyman. It's very, very Orwellian, the deeper you get into this stuff. But I mean, would you agree with me that 9/11 really, it was a game-changing event, a paradigm-shifting event? And it kind of – everything revolves around 9/11 from a foreign policy perspective, certainly, and our war policy, all these wars we see in the Middle East.
It was a game-changing event, and it is also a product of the Zionist success in gaining effective control of both houses of the Congress – through the appointments process in the Senate of most of the executive branch, of most of the media, and of most of the evangelical Protestant pastors. They assiduously began cultivating the latter group in the early and mid-1960s. You, of course, know of CUFI, you know, Christians United for Israel, which is essentially an AIPAC clone working on that side of the house. But you had to get politicians, press, and pulpit together so that the public would not get any disconcerting dissent.
Right. They controlled the narrative.
Exactly. They controlled it on
all subjects of any major import. They have controlled the narrative and in the discussion and the discourse and in the direction, the flow of the conversation. Yes.
There is no precedent for it historically. There's absolutely no precedent historically. Anything. Yeah. Anywhere.
And you know what's interesting is I think researching 9/11 and coming to these conclusions and just clearly seeing how it was all of these Israeli Zionist stooges, or not stooges, but outright agents, you know, operating in the government, you know, these dual citizens, almost all of them were Jewish with direct ties to Israel. Understanding how 9/11 happened, then that's what led me to realize just how our government has been totally taken over. Like, I didn't realize the extent of it until I figured 9/11 out. And then I look at the government, I'm like, oh, wow. Yeah. This is a government that is controlled by a foreign entity. I mean, that's what it is at this point.
Yeah, it is. It very much is. And, you know, it's as I've said to a number of people, both on interviews and off them, you know, it's an all or nothing exercise. It's a throw of the dice to get it all or lose everything. Because if for any reason the American people ever realize what's happened, what the price we have paid and for whom we have paid it, Israel's going to look like a parking lot no matter what the cost.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm half Jewish and I'll probably go too. You know, it's going to be just there is the things that I think the culture still has this. There is a latent ruthlessness here that has demonstrated itself periodically over time, you know, not just with the Native Americans, you know, the behavior of the Union armies in the Civil War ripped apart the South, you know, in a way that absolutely horrified the armies of Europe, who were not exactly cream puffs and shrinking violets. The bombing campaigns against Germany and Japan, you know, just taking civic cities where virtually everyone in it was a civilian, most of them women and children, and burning them to the ground. And doing it with a deliberate policy, Curtis LeMay expressed this in Europe, you know, breaking the morale of the German army by killing their families and their cities behind them. That's ruthless.
Yes, that's a very good point. Yeah, we do.
Even in the Cold War, you know, we asserted that the Soviet Union, that the Soviet government cared nothing for its own people. And our nuclear strategy was based on a presumption that in the event of war with the Soviet Union, we would destroy their cities and kill their people, even though we presumed that their government cared nothing about them.
Right.
That was the essence of our strategy. You know, and if a trace of that survives and people look and say, we've had maybe, I guess now probably 100 to 105,000 dead and wounded, about $7-8 trillion in expenditures, our wonderful TSA where we get to get patted down and searched every time we fly and move, NSA with its wiretapping. Oh, and we've killed or made refugees of several million people too. And that the American people suddenly realize, you mean it's because of them? You know, there's going to be a convulsion. Every lamppost in Washington is going to have a congressman or a bureaucrat hanging from it.
And frankly, that's how it should be. I mean, what these people have done is so monstrous, so outrageous, so evil, so despicable. I mean, that's what it would have to happen. I mean, that's what happens when this, you know, when criminals carry out crimes like this and people realize it and wake up to it. And I've argued from day one that 9/11 has the potential to serve as this wake up call. Like, look, it's so clear what the government and what the media have told us about 9/11. Is not only impossible, it's insulting how ridiculous the official narrative is. Anybody that can think for themselves, that has the slightest bit of critical thinking skills and independent thinking skills, should be able to see right through the official narrative. I mean, it's that insulting. It's that childish. It's ridiculous. And I, you know, one of the points that you made, I remember, was just looking at Building 7, for example. I mean, if that doesn't get you to stop and think that maybe we've been lied to, I mean, I don't know what will. And one thing I kind of wanted to bring up before we get more into all the ties to Israel, you know, with 9/11, is there are a lot of very powerful psychological and emotional barriers to really accepting the truth about 9/11 and to even start thinking critically about it. Because it was a very traumatizing event. It was I've argued that it was really a psychological terrorism. The way it was carried out in the media, the narratives that came out of it, you know, all the propaganda associated with it. Mm-hmm. It's very, very powerful. And I wanted you to maybe comment on that, or if you've done any thought on that.
It is. And what's intriguing to me, though, is, I mean, it was all of those things. You know, it was very traumatic, and it was because of except for the shelling of an occasional coastal city in World War II, you know, anything outside of the South has never experienced war since 1865. And even the South, that was a very long time ago. But the intriguing thing is that what was traumatizing to Americans struck many people overseas. And I got this in French, German, British, English language, Japanese newspapers. You know, they would lose tens of thousands of people in a single night. You know, 50,000 people in Tokyo killed in one night, you know, without the nuclear weapons. You know, tens of thousands of people, and they gritted their teeth and kept going. And the Americans, there was a picture in one of them, it was a British paper, which showed Uncle Sam with a diaper and his stars and stripe hats on, and a couple of buildings burning in the background, and he's crying and having a temper tantrum. And the headline was, "Pity he doesn't grow up."
Right.
You know, what was traumatizing to us was something that would have been a pinprick to several European countries who really underwent some horrific experiences in World War II, and I would include the Soviet Union, Russia in that, and that it's that Americans are extremely comfortable and mostly pampered, and I don't think we have the same grit that we had in the 20s and 30s and 40s and probably 50s.
No doubt about that. Yes.
It's very, very different. It's, you know, and I don't enjoy saying this, you know, I was very proud as a U.S. Marine and I always stood up for the Star Spangled Banner and all the rest of this, but America is very much like the classic schoolyard bully in a global sandbox. You know, as long as we can beat up on people from a distance and not get hurt, which is why we have our affinity for missiles launched from submarines and destroyers, you know, we're fine. But boy, let us start taking casualties. And there's a, you know.
Yes, there's
something,
so true.
Something has gone out of us. And I don't know if it's been culturally excised or what, but there's something out of it. I have a very deep suspicion that if we were to have another Great Depression, instead of buckling down and pulling ourselves up, we would buckle away, throw the buckles away, and collapse. And the cities would certainly collapse.
Yeah. Well, I think it's pretty obvious to me just looking around at modern America that American spirit, that American grit has largely been removed from us. I mean, I think there's been a sustained and systematic subversion of our culture, not only in America, but all throughout the Western world. I think this is very clear. I mean, think about it on a modern college campus nowadays. They have safe spaces and you can't talk about You can't talk about controversial topics and everybody. I mean, it's just disgusting. It's despicable. It's nothing like the people who built and founded this country. There's no doubt about that. I mean, I think that there are still like authentic red-blooded Americans out there, guys like you and I, but I mean, you know, we're a dying breed and it's very sad. So, I mean, I agree with you. And your point about America not really experiencing any sort of conflict and violence, I think is all very true. And you know, think about how powerful the media is in America, especially the television images mm-hmm. that are presented on television. I mean, everybody has their entire reality, their entire perception of reality shaped through the television. At least that's how it used to be. And it certainly was like mm-hmm. that on 9/11. I mean, I think the internet in the past 10 or more years has changed a lot of that. But mm-hmm. the media as a medium of communication and control has been very, very powerful. And I think that kind of explains a lot of the psychological and emotional barriers when it comes to 9/11, because the images were so powerful. And, yep. you know, the people falling out of it. We can maybe get into this later on, but I've seen some research that to me is fairly convincing that a lot of the images that were presented on television were not exactly authentic. But I don't want to get into that right now. But again, my point is that as a medium of communication, it was very exploitative and it was used to the max on 9/11.
And it's not only television. Obviously, the same people who control the television networks also control Hollywood.
Yes.
They control
the newspapers.
Most of the publishing industry, not both textbooks and professional books. So the academic narrative is there. Interestingly enough, they also control CMT. So we had all of these nice songs on 9/11 by Alan Jackson and others, you know, that keeping the pot stirring on that side. And when the Dixie Chicks made some sarcastic comments about Bush and his wars, that particular part of the entertainment industry crushed them.
Yes, that's a good point. That's a very good point. Yeah, there are a number of songs reinforcing the official 9/11 narrative. And that's true. I mean, the television was very powerful and instrumental in all of this, but it was just an overall information assault on our minds, really. I mean, everyone was saying the same thing, including on the day that 9/11 happened. I mean, you can find an interview with a guy on the street, for God's sake, and he's being interviewed, and I think this was staged. I don't accept this at all, but you can find this on YouTube, where he's being interviewed, and he literally just it tells the official narrative, like what the government later, yeah. you know, institutionalized. It's incredible, you know. So the information assault was certainly there, no doubt about it.
One of the things that probably the most ridiculous part of it, a minor one but ridiculous, but supposedly this individual, well-dressed individual, comes up to a New York City police detective and gives him the passport of one of the people who is supposedly a pilot of one of the two planes. That, you know, now that in itself should convince you, if it were true, that we should all convert to Islam, because Allah was able to protect the passport from the impact, you know, on the person of the pilot of this plane, from impact, explosion, fire, and a 900 to 1,000 foot fall, and have it drop right next to the building intact. What more can you ask? What more can you ask for in terms of miracles?
and that's what I mean by how insulting the official story is, and what they expect us to believe. They expect us to believe that. Yep. I mean, I don't know. The only word I is insulting. I mean, I'm insulted when I'm as a grown adult that has a mind of his own. I'm just mm-hmm. expected to believe that, and if I don't, I'm denounced as a conspiracy theorist and, you know, mm-hmm. an anti-Semite and all these other ridiculous labels.
Yeah.
Anyways, I wanted to go back because I remember looking into this. You know, if you every single aspect of 9/11, all of it ties directly to Jewish individuals primarily, and many of these Jewish individuals have direct ties to Israel and to the government, and they're all Zionists, of course. when you think about the privatization of the World Trade Center complex itself, mm-hmm. there's a number of Jews involved in it. A number of them have ties directly to Israel. You look at the ownership of the towers with Larry Silverstein. Mm-hmm. Here's a Jewish guy, again, direct ties to Israel, used to talk to Netanyahu on the phone, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, you know, a major Zionist, a major Jewish criminal. Key to all of this. So he owns the complex. You look at the official investigation. You look at the security at the complex. You look at the official government investigation into the matter with, what's the guy's name? Who wrote the 9/11 commission report?
Oh, God, yes. I know what you mean.
Philip Zelikow.
Philip Zelikow,
yeah.
In fact, he gave a talk at the University of Virginia on the first anniversary of 9/11 and stated very clearly, and it's been taped, that the reason for wanting war with Iraq was the security of Israel.
Just openly saying it.
One year after the event, and about 5 months before we attacked Iraq.
Yeah, I mean, these people could not be more obvious with their agenda. And again, if you point this stuff out, they just call you an anti-Semite and a conspiracy theorist. That's how childish all of this is. But if you look at the official investigator, Zelikow, a Jewish guy with direct ties to Israel, a major Zionist. Sure. You look at the mm-hmm. Bush administration, you brought up some of the guys, Feith, Wolfowitz, Richard Perle. There's a number of them that I can't even think off the top of my head. All of this you can read about on the internet. There's a number of good sources. Christopher Bolin is probably one of the top, you know, authors that's dealt with these subjects. Yeah. Kevin Barrett has written pretty extensively about it. Dr. Jim Fetzer has written extensively mm-hmm. about it. I've written about it. I've talked about it on a number of podcasts in the past. Mm-hmm. This is all very clear and very, very easy to find out. I mean, you can... Everything I'm saying, you can go verify for yourself very, very easily is my point.
Right. What you might want to do, on your page, is to put a list of the members of PNAC, you know, from Cheney and Rumsfeld on down, and then next to that, put the positions they held in the first Bush administration.
Right. Yep.
And it's an interesting picture of basically of PNAC as the U.S. government.
It basically was. And
Scooter Libby, for example, on Cheney's staff. I mean, all these people.
And Scooter Libby is another Jewish guy with, again, direct ties to Israel. Another good point that I know you made in some of your earlier writings was the fact that Israel has a long history of carrying out, you know, these like false flag type events where they organize and sort of set up an attack and then blame it on their enemies to justify something, right? I mean, you know, you look at the founding of the State of Israel and you know, this is what they were all about. They've been doing this for decades. They're still doing it today. That's what 9/11 was a classic Israeli false flag operation where they set it up, they made it happen, they executed it, and they blamed the people who, you know, they wanted to basically to start all this to kickstart this global war on terrorism.
Yeah, that was really interesting. I know they did that in the mid 50s. They had a plan to assassinate Western businessmen in Egypt and blame it on Egypt to justify the war. And the intelligence operation was blown, and so they went in anyway. The day before the 9/11 attacks on September 10th, and I believe this was in the Washington Times, not the Washington Post, there was an excerpt of summary of an army study at Fort Leavenworth, which was looking at, you know, what would be the probable scenarios if the U.S. sent peacekeeping forces into Israel and Palestine, basically to oversee an Israeli-Palestinian peace arrangement. That was when some people were still naive enough to think there could be such a thing. And they made the point, you know, that Mossad was and this was in print, that Mossad was an extremely ruthless organization, that it had the capacity to attack American forces and make it look as if Arabs had done it.
See, and our government
knows this.
The next
day we get 9/11.
Yeah.
Well, our government is it, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, exactly. And again, they do have a long history of doing these sorts of things, which you can find, you know, again, just Google some of this stuff. There's all sorts of information online. And, you know, most people, I'm sure, are familiar with the USS Liberty event.
Yeah.
You know, again, another classic example of a false flag attack. So anyways, my point is that they have a long history of doing this. This fits their MO, their you know, how they operate. And it makes sense. I mean, the more you stop and think about it. And you know
what? One thing, by the way, and I should mention this before I forget it. You know, at my age, I tend to forget many things, including where I am. But when I once gave a very challenging presentation, shall we say, on 9/11. It was to an evangelical Protestant church in State College, Pennsylvania. And I was doing that at the invitation of the pastor. And before going into 9/11, I began with the 9/11, not with the Liberty incident. You know, put the schematics on the screen. Here's what happened. Look at the picture of the ship. Look at the picture of the Egyptian horse freighter that they said they thought it was. Look at what they would have seen for 5 hours. And then I took, you know, which basically was a pump primer. You know, they've done it before, and this is an incontrovertible attack. Then I took it to 9/11. And when I finished the presentation, there was about 70 or 80 people in the room, including a few pastors from some of the other Protestant churches in the area. And the pastor there, who has since died of cancer, by the way, got back to me and he said, you know, at the end of that, all but two people believed that the U.S. government explanation for 9/11 was wrong. And almost half believed that Israel was complicit in the attacks. Now, why that matters, this was a church which had alternating U.S. and Israeli flags around it.
Wow.
And
Christian Zionism.
You got it, Christian Zionism. And, you know, but it, starting with the USS Liberty and making it absolutely clear that this was a deliberate attack, and that they had such influence in the U.S. government, even then in 1967, that the Secretary of Defense and the President of the United States would call off American carriers who were planning to launch aircraft to its defense. Say, no, that's what they had back then. Now let's look at 9/11. And a lot more things fall in. They become more willing to accept complicity when they know there's precedent.
Exactly.
But,
yeah.
But and talk, you know, and detailing it with schematics and photographs will help that. And so I would suggest to anyone who's listening to this, if you haven't have an interest in making a presentation to anyone on 9/11, start with the USS Liberty. Start with the USS Liberty. That provides prima facie evidence of the potential to do it.
Yes, exactly. That's a good point. Yeah, and that would be, like, when I was first researching 9/11 and talking about this stuff and writing about it, that, you know, of course, that was kind of like how I started off was, look, they have a history of doing this. We have this example, the USS Liberty. And there's many. I mean, there's dozens and dozens of examples that you can find and read about and document and prove, I mean, through even mainstream sources. Another thing that I would always bring up with people was, look, we have police reports, we have FBI reports of a number of Israeli intelligence operatives that were arrested on the day of 9/11. I mean, that was what was dumbfounding to me, was we arrested a lot of these guys that were involved with carrying out 9/11. Or they, maybe not, I don't know if I could say carrying out, I don't know that for sure, but I do know that they were tied in with what was going on and they seemed to know what was happening. I'm referring to the dancing Israelis,
yeah.
and not just the dancing Israelis. That was probably the most notorious and well-known example of this. But there was a massive Israeli espionage operation that was taking place leading up to 9/11 and the years before 9/11. They were operating in New York. They were operating in Florida and other places in the United States. They were selling drugs. They were casing federal buildings. And a lot of them were presenting themselves as art students. There was a Mossad front, the Urban Movings Systems, and a number of other companies that were tied in with that, if I'm not mistaken. These guys were arrested on 9/11, you know, and the police that were arresting them knew that they were tied in with what was going on. They knew it. And they wrote about it in their police reports, and they're saying, look, we need to investigate this further. And then what happens? Michael Chertoff, a dual citizen, a Jewish man with direct ties to Israel, a dual citizen of Israel, whose family was, if I'm not mistaken, key in founding the state of Israel. You know, these guys are longtime terrorist Mossad operatives, essentially. And, you know, he's the guy in charge at the federal level of investigating 9/11. He lets these guys go back to Israel on visa violations. Meanwhile, they're like the prime suspects in what happened that day, and the police knew about it. That's how outrageous all of this is.
Yeah, my understanding is that a lot of local police agencies, like in Bergen, New Jersey, who arrested those five dancing Israelis in New York City, were extremely unhappy with this, and they were basically told to get out of the way and shut up.
Yeah, in fact, I have, and I'll link this when I post this program, I have the, I'm going to pull it up right now, I have it saved. It's actually the East Rutherford, New Jersey Police Department. I know they were, I think you're right, they were in Bergen, or the Israeli operatives were in Bergen, New Jersey, which is right near there. But this is the police department that arrested these guys. I have the police report right here. And this is, you know, most people listening to this are probably familiar with this police report, but this is what is so insane to me is, I mean, here's proof that something was going on with these Israelis. You know, they seemed to be knowing what was going on. They had fake passports and stuff. I mean, like, these are the most suspicious guys. I mean, so we have proof that there's these Israeli Jewish Mossad agents tied into 9/11. And almost no proof, aside from what the media said, that there was any Arabs involved in this. And there's even reports that these Israeli guys that were arrested were trying to present themselves as Arabs. Again, confirming like this false flag idea. You know, they're setting this all up and trying to blame Muslims. It's, I mean, it's incredible when you really look at this police report. And again, I'll link it so people can.
I understand that there's William Webster, the director of the FBI, somewhere around 2007, had a statement that several of the 9/11 conspirators appeared to still be alive. That one of them was a Saudi Air Force officer. There were several like that. There were apparently six or seven of them, at least six or seven, were still alive, you know, the year after the event, which, again, is reinforcement for Allah, right? What else can you do? You fly into buildings, the planes explode, the buildings explode, you got nothing, and you walk away from it.
Yeah. I'm looking at the police report right here. I should have saved this before we started. Basically, these guys were saying, you know, we're Israelis, we're your friends. It's the Arabs, the Palestinians who are the bad guys. And what's fascinating about all this is these, you know, these local cops, you know, arrest these Israelis. They get them down to the station. And what do you know? The FBI takes over. And again, Michael Chertoff is basically the director of the FBI, you know, in the Justice Department. He winds up letting these guys off and go back to Israel. Have you read a lot of this original source material, like the police report? Yeah, okay.
I have. It's just absolutely. You know, the thing of it is, the local cops tried to do the right thing, that both there and in New York City. They tried to do the right thing. The same thing down in Washington and the Pentagon. You know, you've got this lieutenant from the Arlington Police Department. You know, he's looking at the camera. He's been the first responder there about an hour after the strike, and he said, you know, he says on camera, said, you know, I don't know what's going on. They said me, they told me an airplane hit the Pentagon, and I don't see any airplane parts anywhere. You know, on live television.
Right.
And of course, that disappeared that day too. too. You know, a lot of the stuff is out there and was shown once, but that was only once. And then the fix was in and it was shut down. And the furthest thing that I remember, furthest in terms of time, is that it was September 13th or 14th. There was a small item buried in the back of the first section of the New York Times referencing the dancing Israelis. And it was a very tiny reference to them. That was 3 days afterwards. But basically, after the first day, the fix was in. And only the accepted narrative appeared on television and in the press.
Yeah. Do you remember the Fox News series that Carl Cameron did? You can still find it on YouTube. Do you recall when that aired? Because they were basically exposing a lot of this stuff, like Fox News was. And then, you know, I think it actually literally was Abe Foxman and some, you know, other powerful Jewish leaders got in touch with Fox News and essentially got them to remove it from their website. You can't even find it anywhere on Fox News now. Are you familiar with that? It was a four-part series, but
I don't remember the date of it. I know that there were isolated reports later on PBS talking about the buildings collapsing, that they could not have gone down the way that's been described.
Yes.
You know, they had several with Richard Gage talking about that, a couple of brief interviews on that. But these are very isolated interviews, and they're out there, and they're from stations other than LA, Chicago, New York, Washington.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right about the media basically just parroting the official narrative. And I totally agree. But what is interesting is that at the time, and you can still find this, you know, again, I'm talking about the police reports, mm-hmm. I'm talking about the FBI reports, the Fox News series. Mm-hmm. There was information out there documenting all of this. I mean, it wasn't explicitly saying, look, Israel was behind 9/11. That was never the way it was presented, but it was raising some red flags. Yep. And guys like Christopher Bolin and American Free Press, they were on top of this from the beginning and were documenting all this. Daryl Bradford Smith. Mm-hmm. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that this information is out there. It's very well founded. It's not some conspiracy theory. Mm-hmm. It's not some, you know, something that we're, you know, sort of alleging. I mean, this is proof. We have hard documentation, legitimate evidence and proof tying these people in on all this. Yep. And this, again, goes back to the PNAC document and all these neocons, what they were openly writing about and saying and advocating for. Another good example is, I think it was on the BBC. You could find it on YouTube still. Ehud Barak, who is like a major Israeli politician. I think he was prime minister for a while. He was the defense minister, if I'm not mistaken, a big time in the Israeli government. He's being interviewed on CNN the day of 9/11, basically explaining what was going to happen, saying, oh, look, this is the signature work of Osama bin Laden. There's nobody else that could carry this out. You know, so they had all of their key people in positions to get this narrative out there, to get their agenda kickstarted, and to cement all this stuff in our minds and to institutionalize the narrative.
Well, John, you have to understand, I mean, Osama bin Laden might very well have overseen it. Anyone who can look younger as the years go on and survive more than a year with acute kidney failure, I mean, what more can you ask? I remember that Benazir Bhutto, shortly before she was assassinated, and this may be a causal relationship, you know, said publicly that he had died in December of 2001 in Pakistan. You know,
yeah.
What else?
Yeah.
You know, and then of course Osama's the death of whoever was playing Osama bin Laden. And then you toss the body into the ocean off the deck of an aircraft carrier. Are you kidding me?
I know. Oh yeah. And that was under Obama. Yeah. Obama. Was allegedly responsible for that. Yeah. That was another very insulting, ridiculous thing to witness.
You know, if you proceed on the assumption that Osama bin Laden was still alive at that point in time. This person was probably the single most knowledgeable source about whatever constitutes a terror network out in the world. It would be worth any number of casualties to take him prisoner, to get him alive, get him back, and interrogate him. So what do? You go in, you blast him up, take the body, take it home, dump it off into the ocean so it can't be tested.
Yeah, how ridiculous. And do you remember they had like these fake photos of him? And
yeah.
There was a number of fake photographs of Osama bin Laden, you know, that were presented in the media. But around the time that this happened, which probably would have been, what, like 2010?
Yep.
Yeah. Or maybe even later than that, 2011.
September 2010, I'm not sure.
Okay. Anyway, you know, anybody can just Google it. I'm not going to try to do that and get distracted when I want to ask you about one other document that I found extremely important and extremely relevant, and another primary source document, you know, proving that Israel was definitely somehow connected to what was going on, on 9/11. Are you familiar with the Gerald Shea memo?
No, I'm not.
To the 9/11 Commission. Oh, wow, really? Okay, I'm going to definitely send this to you. I'll post this on my webpage when this podcast is up.
Okay.
It's a memo. Gerald Shea is a lawyer. I know I've researched him in the past. I know he's a lawyer. I'm not sure all the specifics. But he basically submitted a memo to the 9/11 Commission. To the National Commission on Terrorist Attacks Upon the United States. He also submitted it to this the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence and the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. And it's called Israeli Surveillance of the Future Hijackers and FBI Suspects in the September 11th Attacks and Their Failure to Give Us Adequate Warning, The Need for a Public Inquiry. And this was submitted September 15th of 2004.
Oh, really?
And it's fascinating. I mean, this guy put together this memo. He is citing and quoting a number of official government reports, including FBI reports, including DEA reports, FBI reports, police reports, detailing this massive Israeli espionage operation, massive Israeli drug running, wiretapping, telecommunication, you know, involvement in these various telecommunications companies, how they were tied into all this. It's a very, very interesting memo. He submits this and saying, look, I found all this information on my own as an attorney. You guys need to know about this. We need to talk about this. What's going on with all these Israelis that are under investigation and some of them were arrested by our own federal law enforcement agencies? It's a very, very interesting document. I will certainly send it to you.
I will do that.
It's more proof that we have very solid information tying Israel to 9/11. Logistically, like on the ground, like evidence and proof showing that they were involved in all this.
Understood. John, I'm going to have to leave in a couple of minutes, but I'd like to make one quick statement, an admission of error. When I started writing on 9/11, I said, like WTC-7 is the smoking artillery brigade. That's where we focus. And we did on the World Trade Center because of the drama and the fact that everyone focused on that and the buildings coming down and so forth. And that was wrong. I was in error there. I mean, it's the most dramatic, but it's not where we should focus, because even if we persuaded people, a large majority of the American people, of the reality of 9/11 in New York City, how do we mobilize and organize them to do anything about it? Where we should focus is the Pentagon. Even though of the attacks on the Pentagon, for one reason and one reason only, if enough people in the Pentagon come to understand the reality of 9/11, they already have the organization and the capacity to do something about it. They can act.
Yes.
They can act. Anything else, you get outrage. But the outrage would have to be channeled through the U.S. government, which is already bought and paid for by the Israelis. A lot of the senior officers in the Pentagon are now the same way. They have general officers and particularly chiefs of staff or commandants or chief of naval operations have to be confirmed by the Senate. And they know as well as anyone else that they need to make the appropriate pro-Israeli noises if they're going to get confirmed by the Senate Armed Services Committee and by the whole Senate. But there's still a hell of a lot of officers below that level who haven't had to go through that dance. And if they get convinced, if they are persuaded that what attacked them, not in the not too distant past, had its origins in Tel Aviv, they have the organization and the capacity and the power to act.
Yes. Those are the people that we need to convince.
Those are the ones we need. Those are the ones we need to convince. And if the, and the rest of the people, sure, keep the information going out there to as many, much of the American public as possible. Make them very much aware of what happened. I mean, don't stop on that, but start focusing on the Pentagon attacks. Look, your predecessors were sitting in there and people in uniform were killed and the Israelis did it. This was like the USS Liberty magnified 100-fold in terms of duplicity and depravity and treachery. Go for them.
Yes.
And if they buy that, Katie barred the door, the game is over.
Very well said. I completely agree with you. And I hope those types of people are listening to this podcast. And I hope they consider what we're saying and do some research on their own. Because again, everything that I've said in this podcast, I can totally prove and document, you know, with very solid, legitimate evidence. It's not a conspiracy theory. It's not made up. It's not conjecture. You know, we have legitimate proof and evidence to prove everything that we're saying. And, you know, I hope people start connecting the dots. And I know this for sure. You have been instrumental in helping me connect the dots. So I do want to thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I really do appreciate it. And I'd love to do this again in the future.
A pleasure, John. I'll be happy to do it, and I'll send you the link to that video I promised you.
Perfect. Sounds good. Thank you so much, and I will talk to you real soon.
Thank you, John. You take care. Have a good day.
Bye-bye.